Mr. Hall, reel two.
As I was saying, the position was radically changed. I was prepared to fight, to die, but hopefully to live, but certainly to defend England, where I was part and parcel of the English people. I might say that I went into the army not because I believed in the war at that stage in 1940, June, but though my secretary said that as a Union official, though voluntary, I could be in a reserved occupation, I had that feeling that I shouldn't have any privileges, and I was prepared to be with the ordinary lads who were called up, and so I accepted service in the army, though I made the best of it. I didn't get on well with regular sergeant majors and sergeants, but I was a good footballer and played for the battalion. I even played cards with the men, with the lads, in order to be with them. But I was still very much what some people loosely like to call the barrack room lawyer. I don't look upon myself as a barrack room lawyer, but I certainly stood up for my rights as a civilian soldier and for my fellow soldiers.
Before we go on to that, could I go back to something? You talked about the Dutch line and the Pollitt line, the Dutch line being against war and the Pollitt line being for the war, roughly speaking.
Yeah.
But do you recollect any particular individuals whom you were in personal contact with in the Communist Party who supported the opposite line to you, the Pollitt line?
Well, the majority of people in my locality supported the leadership line, as I would put it, then the Pollitt line.
Which locality was that?
So I was in the St. Pancras local. I was then living at Parliament Hill Fields.
So were there no individuals who...
There was one other individual who I lived with, another person, but he, when we were interviewed by the local party committee, he weakened and retracted. I didn't.
Who was he?
Venning, Peter Venning. He was a upper middle class, Oxford, and more susceptible to working class bullying, whereas I threatened to punch the nose of the local secretary when he started to bully me. I don't accept political bullying.
Why should he have bullied you if you were supporting the party line?
No, I was against the In that period, let's be clear, the party line at that point when I was having differences was the Pollitt line. And the local committee, I think the majority of people tend to follow the leadership. I was attempting to think it out for myself, but I was a good party member. I didn't make contact with other people of my thinking, although I heard that a person called Bill Zack, you probably know Molly, or knew Molly, her husband, I heard, was against the Pollitt line. But it only became the Dutt line when Dutt became secretary in place of Pollitt.
So Venning also tended to oppose the war.
Yeah, but he...
He caved in.
He caved in. I was due to meet Ted Bramley, who was the London District Secretary, but by the time this engagement should have been held, the Central Committee had met and Springhall had returned from Moscow, and after arguing for 2 or 3 days, whatever it was, the majority, with the exception of Pollitt, I think, and Campbell, accepted the new Comintern line, which I've called the Dutt line. And Bramley supported the Dutt line, or maybe he was just a good democratic centralist and publicly accepted it.
Who was Springhall?
Springhall was a person I knew quite well and I liked very much. He had been a sailor, I think, in the First World War. He happened to have been at the Comintern in 39. We didn't have a strong political presence in the Comintern following 1935, Dimitrov, Seventh World Congress. The Comintern, for practical purposes, I would say was a non-body, except when the war happened and it was Dimitrov made a declaration on behalf of the Comintern that it was an imperialist war. Though many of us who thought it was an imperialist war had not then read the Dimitrov article. But we did hear in the course of our differences that the Communist Party of India and the Communist Party of South Africa, who we were closely linked with, had opposed the war at its outset as an imperialist war. Not that that's important. I'm saying that I had my own individual views, but democratic centralism was so strong in those days that it was unheard of for any of us to go outside the correct machine to discuss differences.
Did you know about the differences in the Communist Party of Great Britain's leadership about interpreting the war?
Only after the event.
So you had no inkling at the time?
No. I had an inkling that something was happening because, as it happened, I was working back in 16 King Street at that time. Workers' bookshop that I'd worked for had been wound up, and I was one of the persons from the old apparatus who started Central Books, and I was then the managing director of Central Books.
That was at 16 King Street.
We went back to 16 King Street just to rebuild this organ, which was the literature apparatus of the Communist Party. So I knew something was going on, but we were a very well-disciplined party in those days. Those of us who were in key positions, and we wouldn't think of discussing internal matters outside or with any other party member until it was official.
16 King Street, of course, was the Communist Party headquarters,
headquarters. That's correct.
Now, going on to your call-up for the army, how did it actually take place?
Well, for discharge purposes, I was the 25 group, so I suppose I was the 25 years of all. I was in my 25th year. Yes, I'll be 25 in the September. And I went through the ordinary routine of a medical. Then on the train to Portland, and then went through my recruit training. It was a training battalion of the Welsh Regiment.
Were you given any choice as to what unit you would go in or what job you would do?
Well, not initially. At one of the interviews I'd asked, I think, for the Navy, but there was a great demand for the Navy. But I was sent into the infantry, and I think it was because it was such a critical period in the war, June 40. Dunkirk was around about that period, and whilst I was in my recruit days, we had people coming in, we gave them temporary billets, who'd come in from Le Havre, which was just across from Portland Bill. So northern France was collapsing as I joined up, or I was conscripted.
And what about the job that you were going to do in the army? There was no choice about getting a job as a tradesman or anything like that?
Eventually, after the Battle of Britain, when we came back to barracks, there was a reallocation, and I volunteered to become a battalion signaller in the signal section of the battalion, and was going through some training for the signal section when the battalion was practically, well, no, I'm jumping stages. The battalion was then withdrawn from Portland Bill, and taken, sent to Burnham-on-Sea, North Somerset, where we were a mobile column. But I think by this time, this was January of 1941, by this time it was fairly clear that I think it was clear that there wasn't that great need for as many infantrymen in the army as there had been. And our battalion was began to be dismantled. And I volunteered to go overseas with the Royal Signals. So I was sent up to Catterick, and in March, April of 41, we were entrained for Gurek, and I went on board the Empress of Japan.
Before we go on to you going out east, if I could revert back to your first contact with the army, was it what you'd expected, or were there surprises for you when you first had contact with the army?
It was to some degree what I expected. I thought the the cultural level, I'll put it that way, of the regular soldier, I was rather taken aback. I didn't fit in. I don't think many conscripts of my group fitted in. We were all trade unionists, printers, booksellers, engineers. Well, not so much engineers, because they were reserved. We had the odd miner who'd volunteered. And so my general impression of the lads in my platoon was that they were there on sufferance. They wanted the war. They supported the war, but they wanted the war over as quickly as possible. And they didn't want what we call bullshit. They weren't interested in bullshit, although there was the odd one who would take to it, and they would be promoted acting unpaid lance corporals, but that was not my cup of tea. I was more interested in the conditions in the battalion, the food, the discipline. Yes, I'm for discipline, but it's got to be thinking discipline. So I didn't, but as I say, I was a good footballer and I played for the battalion team, so I sort of made my own little niche in the battalion. And if you're a footballer on a Saturday afternoon, you don't have to do guard duty. So every Saturday, at least I was off for Saturday night. And I'd do my fair of guards during the week.
Can you give any, were there clashes with authority, any incidents as far as you were concerned?
Yes, when we came back from the beach at Churchhope Cove, we were put into some empty houses, still not yet back to barracks. And we were told we couldn't leave the billet. This was our first night after, say, 6 weeks with our boots on. Although I was the odd sod who took his boots off. I never slept with my boots on. I don't find them very comfortable, but I could have been court-martialed, I suppose, for disobeying orders, but nobody knew. And I put them on when I had to go on duty, naturally. But when we were withdrawn to this billet, I said, come on, let's all go out and get some fish and chips and a beer. And everybody in the billet was all for it. And the pub and the fish shop was only 50 yards up the road. But unfortunately, on our way to the fish and chip shop, we met the sergeant, the company sergeant major. And he said, Hall, he knew my name, where are you going to? I said, I'm just going for some fish and chips. He says, get back to your boat. When I turned around, everybody else had disappeared, except two of us. But I was up on a charge, and I got jankers. But I was a kind of hero, because in jankers was done in the cookhouse, peeling spuds. And I think I got the best grub in the cookhouse, and lashings of tea, and not too many spuds to peel. So there was sympathy in the ranks, but
It doesn't sound as though discipline was all that harsh, right?
Oh, no, it wasn't terrible. No, I don't think it can be too harsh with conscripts. Not mature conscripts. I think the most vulnerable people in the army, in my experience, were the 18-year-olds. They were much more impressionable and amenable.
Even the conscripts who were 18, you mean?
Well, yes. Well, it was 20 at those days, but I'm thinking later on in the war when I met them.
In what way were they more vulnerable?
Because they were younger and hadn't the background. They'd been brought up in the war. They hadn't the trade union political background that many of us had. I'm not saying everyone in the army was a communist, but the vast majority, I would think, that the rank and file were at least, in those days, Labour supporters. And that was proved in 1945 by the forces vote.
Was your trade union and political background obvious to the NCOs?
Not to them, but it was obvious to the people in my unit because, again, my best pal was a member of the London Society of Compositors. You tend to find somebody that you link up with. Another person that I was very friendly with was an ex-YCLer from Stepney. But in those days it was said that every young Jewish person had been through the Young Communist League. He was Jewish. Another person that I befriended, completely incompatible as personalities, was the son of a Salvation Army missionary who'd been in China. But I was interested in him and his background. And I think he and I also had another common link. We were the only two. We were the only two in the barrack room who wore pyjamas.
What did the rest wear?
They just went to bed in their vest and pants, I think. And I think they only did this out of conformity, thinking they thought pyjamas were a bit middle class, I suppose. I don't know. This other lad also, by the way, knelt and said his prayers every night. And he was in the next bed to me, and I defended his right to say his prayers, even though I didn't say mine. I was not a Christian. I'd been brought up where I didn't think there was any need for the hypothesis of a God.
What did the others say about him doing his
prayers? Oh, I used to take the mickey out of him, but I settled their hash because I was a different person. I mean, they treated me as a... I was all right in the sense that I played football, played cards and went out and drank a beer with them. Not that I was a drinker, but it was all part of my communist outlook to be in with the lads.
Did they rag him in a cruel way?
Not really. It was just... Well, you know what it is for a sensitive person who wears pyjamas and says his prayers in a barrack room of 30 men. It was odd to only accept to a communist.
Now, how long was your initial training for?
Well, we were still in training from the June, really, to the September. We were still going through different parts of training, but we were not well equipped. That was the other side. We used to have to borrow. I think the Bren gun went from platoon to platoon. My training would consist of my personal weapon, which was a 303, Lee Enfield 303. I would be able to strip and put together a Bren gun, and I'd use that on the range. I'd use the rifle on the range as well. And then... an anti-tank gun, but we had few of them, but we were each trained to use one. Then we were acquainted with the Mills bomb, and we do the usual drills and field craft and route marches and all the girls with just being an ordinary infantry soldier.
So it was obvious to you in the summer of 1940 that Britain was ill-equipped in case the invasion was
in. Yes. We even had some of our junior, the companies, we were the senior company because we were, the companies must have, as they were trained, distributed to other Welsh regiments, of the Welsh. And as we were the senior company, we were the best equipped. I think we were F company, and the A and B companies had, I think it was Ross rifles from Canada. I don't know if you've come across the Ross rifle, but it was a... Well, we were very well ill-equipped. The beach was mined, and we put barbed wire aprons all over the island. And another amusing experience was on Portland Bill, there was a borstal. And we had the borstal lads helping us, digging trenches on the cliff tops and barbed wire aprons. And they used to tell us what fools we were, father, to be in borstal instead of being in the army. You know, the big lads, they still had to wear short trousers. I mean, I'm only 5 foot two, and some of these were 6 feet. I was in my army battle dress, and they were in their short trousers. We saw they didn't do too much work. We just treated them as other human beings.
What was the motivation of you and your comrades in the army at that time about the war in general? Did people accept the line of defending the country and the need for the war?
Well, I didn't, in my first months, I didn't discuss politics in the barrack room, not directly. It was a bleak politics, what you might term the same for the same reason that I joined boxing clubs and football clubs and went to the Saturday night hops as a young communist. It was to be with the in contact with ordinary people and hear what they've got to say. So I was very interested in what they were saying. But they, in the main, accepted that the general line of the propaganda that Hitler was the menace and they should defend it. And some of them might have had doubts about Chamberlain, but they weren't very political. Good trade unionists, but not political in my sense.
Though, of course, Chamberlain had been replaced by Churchill by that time.
By that time, which I didn't see as a great change. I mean, I only was convinced that Churchill was a great change after I'd left England and was at sea when he made his announcements about Russia was now our great ally.
This is jumping ahead to 1941 now.
That's right.
Was there much attempt at impregnating you, as it were, with a regimental esprit de corps as far as the Welsh regiment was concerned?
Not really. In fact, we were a bit of a ragtag and bobtail because I met my section sergeant, my platoon sergeant, was from the Dorsets. And the Dorset, we were in Dorset. It's rather strange for me to be a Geordie working in London, called up into the Welsh regiment. I mean, if I'd wanted to be in a regiment where I had some affinity to, it would have been the Durham Light Infantry. But I think they put companies in the Durham Light Infantry. I don't know whether this was method or madness. I don't think there was, there was one Welshman in my platoon, and he'd come from London.
So there was no great feeling of pride in being in the Welsh regiment?
No. I'd got nothing against the Welsh. I had great sympathy with the South Wales, and if it had been the South Wales Borderers, maybe different. The mining communities of Wales and the mining communities of Durham have much in common.
On the initial training again, was that conducted in a harsh or a fair way or what?
Well, it seemed to go up in the order of rank. Our sergeant was a reasonable man. But I think the company sergeant major saw his role as discipline, and above him was the regimental sergeant major. And I personally couldn't take to that kind of mentality. I just thought they were just barking machines. No, the only side of the army that I felt unnecessary was the continuous drill, which was supposed to make us feel that we were part of a unit, you know.
But would the NCOs in charge of your initial training try to humiliate you?
No, they might, the odd one, but no. It was water off a duck's back as far as I was concerned. I still had my mind, I could still think, I could still read. I've always been a great reader, and although at that time I was more interested in studying my fellow soldiers and being in their company. I wasn't concerned about the CSMs and RSMs, but you know, I remember one day a CSM coming around telling me to get out of that fucking bed. So my retort was, "Is that what kind of bed it is?" I didn't know that.
How did he react?
Oh, you know, this sort of thing. Just got on his hind legs and, but just ignored it, really. No, they knew that. They knew they were on a sticky wicket, I think, the regulars.
So you were able to answer back in that kind of way, were you?
Well, I was. I mean, others didn't, but...
But you weren't victimised for it?
Not really. My name was known, so that when the appropriate time came, I could be on a charge. But I was only on a charge once in that battalion, and that was when, as I said earlier, I left the billet against orders.
Now, going on to the question of you going overseas, can you tell me about how you got there?
Yes. I was, in a sense, looking forward to the trip overseas. It may have been romanticism on my part, but we had an inkling we were going to India from the kit that was issued to us. We could have been going to the Middle East, but we went to Gurik, and the most monotonous time was 3 days on board the Empress of Japan, tied up in the Clyde, waiting to leave. But we left the Clyde after 3 days on board with an aircraft carrier, battleships, cruisers, destroyer. Oh, there was a real collection, tremendous convoy. And we took about 7 or 8 weeks to get to India. So going out of the Clyde, we went north. Then we went west. Then we went south. So we were in, no doubt we were in the Caribbean area at one time, but we had our own bush telegraph system of trying to get intelligence. This is the thing about the British Army. There's always ways of getting information. But the first sight of land was when we steamed east and tied up at Freetown. We weren't allowed ashore. The convoy was too big, and we just were there for supplies, probably fresh water and so on. And then, after about a week there, we